Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday. It is the 26th of January, and a delight to have you all with us. We have a great panel today. Let me introduce. We have got a full group, and I have the studio all to myself. How did that work out? Oh, well, you know, the weather was supposed to be bad, and it's bad in some places. So what we have is a lot of people being careful, as they should be. Other people are far away. And so you bring everybody together, and here we go. It'll be like those old COVID days from, you know, a year, 2 years ago. So it's wonderful to have you all here. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and we'll get started. We have with us today Alan Chartok, of course. Good morning, Alan. From a taping of the Media Project. How are you?
That's right. It was a good show, and everybody was on their toes. Rex Smith, of course, our leader,
Always on his toes.
Yes, he was on his toes. He's tall, you know, compared to me, so always
doesn't
like
need to be on his toes. Yeah. Well, good morning. Good to have you here. Albany's Chief City Auditor Dorsey Appliers joins us. Good morning, Dorsey. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I am great and so happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you on the program. Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, is with us. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning, Joe, and everyone. Good to be with you. Sorry I'm not there in person, but I'll bring you these live reports today from the Woodstock, New York, Greater Metroplex.
Well, we thank you for that. That's a good job. We need that, actually. We also welcome the chairman of Capital District Latinos, Dan Arizari, on the program. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm feeling really good. I feel like George Santos after he won the Nobel Prize. So,
yeah, very happy.
He didn't win one of them. He won two of them.
Yes, a couple, just in case. And we're delighted that from Mexico, Linda Ellerbe, Peabody, an Emmy award-winning journalist, just an icon in the world of journalism and television. And it's a great pleasure to have Linda with us. Good morning, Linda. How are you?
I am fine, and I have watched the beautiful snow that has fallen up there in the last few days, now slightly turned to rain. But it's just so beautiful to watch from a distance.
From Mexico.
From under a palm tree where it's 78 degrees. And I did just say that, yes.
Yeah. Now, Luna is with you?
Luna is with me.
And
Rolf is with me. Rolf is not with me. Rolf will be here in a couple of weeks. Sunshine will never be down here. She's too big to fly.
For those
of you who don't know, Sunshine is our new, rather large dog.
Your new acquisition. A lovely. It's a lab, right? It's a yellow lab.
No, she's a golden.
A golden retriever. That's a shame that sucks for her, but, you know. But Luna will enjoy it. That's good.
Luna does enjoy it. Luna is lying next to me here in the grass. Happily, we've been out for our morning walk, and she's happy to be back and had her breakfast, and I'm happy to be with all you good people. It's like being at home without the cold.
Yeah, but you're rubbing it in, you know, sitting there in the sun.
There is a little bit of gloating there, yes. I just checked the weather, and it's going to be up to 78 today and
that's
sunny
lovely.
All day.
Yeah, well, that's lovely. Well, you know, nobody more deserves it than you. So that's you and
Luna. No, we all deserve it.
Well, that's true. But you enjoy it
well,
on
sir.
Our behalf. All right, everyone, let's get started. We do welcome you to be a part of our program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. A lot going on in the news, a lot to talk about, and I thought I would begin with the story about tanks. Now, we haven't talked a lot about this issue, although it's been going on in the news for the past several days. And so this is the Biden tank plan and sending tanks to Ukraine. The headline in the New York Times says how Biden reluctantly agreed to send tanks to Ukraine. The decision unlocked a flow of heavy arms from Europe and inched the United States and its NATO allies closer to direct conflict with Russia. President Biden's announcement Wednesday that he would send M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine came after weeks of tense back-channel negotiations with the Chancellor of Germany and other European nations, who insisted that the only way to unlock a flow of heavy European arms was for the U.S. to send tanks of its own. The decision, however reluctant, now paves the way for German-made Leopard 2 tanks to be delivered to Ukraine in 2 or 3 months, provided by several European nations. You thought your shipping time for your jacket was a long time. Yeah. 3 months. While it is unclear whether it will make a decisive difference in the spring offensive that President Zelensky is now planning to take back territory seized by Russia, it is the latest in a series of gradual escalations that has inched the U.S. and its NATO allies closer to direct conflict with Russia. All right, Alan.
So what's new? In other words, this is the kind of confrontation that goes on between this country and the Russians and has for, you know, a jillion years. I'm not surprised by it, and I think that we all have to sort of stand by and hope that it doesn't escalate.
Ira Fussfeld.
Well, I'm a little surprised about one thing, not that they're ultimately decided to send the tanks, but as you described it in your lead-in, that Biden supposedly was reluctant to do this. And that surprises me, because he certainly has seemed to be all in right from the beginning, and most Americans would say rightly so. So the fact that he seems not to have been leading on this, I'm not necessarily going to criticize it, but I am surprised by it. The other thing I heard in one of the reports this morning was that Germany was reluctant to step forward and needed the U.S. to get in there so that Germany would not look alone and would not look to be as aggressive as it is. Hasn't been known to be militarily through two world wars, and they are apparently very sensitive to that. So, as you also point out, these tanks are not going to show up on the shipping dock tomorrow. It's sort of like ordering a new car. They've got to build this thing up, and apparently it's extremely difficult to operate. So a lot of training is required. So there's more of a symbolic nature to this right now, informing the Russians that the NATO countries still mean business and this stuff is coming, but there will not be apparently any immediate impact because the tanks won't be there.
The Defense Secretary of the United States, Lloyd Austin, only last week dismissed the idea of sending the Abrams tank, with the aide saying its, quote, long tail of supply and repair vehicles was too complex for the stretched Ukrainian forces to operate. That's to your earlier point, Ira. Just yesterday, Austin said these tanks are further evidence of our enduring, unflagging commitment to Ukraine and our confidence in the skill of Ukrainian forces. Linda Ellerbe.
Well, it's interesting. I was listening to earlier to the notion that Biden was reluctant. Here, I think part of that is that presidents generally like to make decisions based on their own ideas rather than being forced into something. And in this case, I think you can make a case that Biden was pushed in some ways into doing this. My friend Lucian Truscott IV wrote a column yesterday that spoke to an issue that I think it's important that we bring up here, of what might be behind a lot of the negotiations here, quite frankly, on Biden's side, and what Germany's doing and why Germany is waiting, because it's not good optics for Germany to go in first, but Germany was also waiting for the U.S. for another reason. And that is Germany and France and Canada, all of these nations, all of the NATO nations, not Canada, are waiting because they don't really trust the U.S. at the moment. And the reason they don't is Donald Trump. And this goes back, and Lucian wrote about this yesterday, goes back to when he was president and he was dismissive of the millions of Europeans who died in two world wars. Do you remember how he didn't go to the cemetery because he might get his hair messed up? And how he called them, later it was discovered, he called those people who died in those wars losers. And couldn't seem to figure out. And then even recently, he's still talking about that NATO, the U.S., if another NATO nation is attacked, that the U.S. by the Soviet Union, or by Russia in this case, that the U.S. might not come to their aid at all. And these nations are looking at the U.S. and saying, you're going to lead or not? Who are you? You having another Donald Trump come along? What are you going to do? And that lit a fire under Joe's feet. And I think, Joe, if there's a reluctance there, it's not a reluctance to help Ukraine. It's a reluctance to be forced into defending that the U.S., being forced into defending that the U.S. is there for NATO, is there for the Allies and for the treaties it has signed, that it will honor those treaties. Does anybody else here enjoy the notion of blaming Donald Trump on this, too?
Why not?
For this, too? I do.
Yeah, I have no problem with that. Dorsey.
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting dynamic here. I think for President Biden, it's a fine line that he's walking. And there's a distinction between Biden, President Biden and his cabinet, and it's clear based on some of the statements that have been made where members of his cabinet made statements about the complexities of the equipment and Ukrainian soldiers not being able to navigate and operate. And that was a different tune that was sung most recently. And that distinction is the political nature of this conversation, whereas Biden is a politician and members of his cabinet are not. They're speaking from a more practical, logical standpoint, assessing the truth of the matter from their vantage point, and also suggesting that some of the tanks from Germany, you know, they're close in proximity. They would get there quicker. They're less complex. Wouldn't it just make sense for them to make the first move? But President Biden understands the politics of the situation, hence why he's the president. And there's also intel that members of his cabinet that won't have, members of the average American won't have. And so we are all outsiders looking in, making decisions based on what we see. But also we need to understand that there's information that we just will not have access to. So it's a fine line. President Biden does not want war with Russia. While I don't think there's a fear factor, it's just what's in the best interest of the United States. So he's balancing what's in the best interest for this country, but also balancing that with this role that we play as a superpower on the global stage. And that was alluded to, and the responsibility that comes with that. And so carefully balancing that, he made the first move, I suspect. There's a notion, I'll end with this so that others could chime in here. There's a notion that culture eats policy for breakfast. And I would say in this case, the culture of politics eats policy. And so this was politically the right thing to do for President Biden. And it was the decision that needed to be made. He understands what's at stake. While not wanting to go to war with Russia is something that's weighing heavily, the other piece of this is what happens if Russia overtakes Ukraine and all of the partners supporting Russia in this endeavor. What does that mean for the United States and other parts of the world. So he understands that very clearly.
Danny Rosari, we have about a minute, but we'll certainly give you more time on the other side if you need it.
I'm worried about the doomsday clock, which is recently ticked that much closer to what, the apocalypse, the end, whatever the measure is. Because this is an escalation and there's no way, other way to look at it. I'm also concerned about Russia's allies. What are the Chinese going to do about this? Is the Chinese government going to see that it needs to align itself more with Russia because they're having problems with their gas supply? You know, things like that that we not may not really understand the implications of, but could very possibly push China into a different stance in this conflict. What about Iran? It's already proven that it's a willing partner with Russia. That's a concern for me, and I'm also concerned about the implications for our budget. We all know about the Iraq conflict and what that did to the deficits, and you know, our children and their children's children will be paying the price for this. And I also understand that there's a lot at stake globally in terms of allowing Russia to just invade another country with impunity. But there's a lot that's at play here, and if things don't go the right way, you know, we're looking at a whole different global landscape here. But
we'll pause there for a moment, and we'll come we'll talk more about doomsday on the other side of the break. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Dorcia Players, Dan Arizari, Ira Fussfeld, and Linda Ellerby on the panel this morning. We welcome your letters. We'll get to those in just a moment. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. During the break, Linda, I was checking out Lucian Truscott's article that you were referring to. The lead to that article is great. The headline: "The Cost of Trump's 4 Years of NATO Niggling." Yeah. Ukrainians died while Europe and the U.S. pissed around about sending tanks to Ukraine. Kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
Kind of sums it up. Lucian doesn't mince words.
well said. Let's go to the letters that we have gotten, and we go to Robert. We are all on a ship together in this storm. Fear of an imaginary doomsday is a wasteful thought. Biden is doing better than any Republican might. We still have peace. If Russia were to take Ukraine, we never would have peace again. We must support Ukraine till the end. That from Robert. We then go to, in this discussion about tanks for Ukrainians, writes Mike, is the tooth-to-tail problem. Tanks require a long logistical chain, parts, ammo, maintenance. Deploying Leopards makes more military sense because Leopards are used by multiple European countries, which all have the necessary logistics in place relatively near Ukraine to assist Ukraine as tanks inevitably break down, need spare parts, etc. Deploying the M1 Abrams, on the other hand, complicates the tooth detail problem. There are fewer were maintenance depots, parts, and less availability. I think Biden announced the deployment of M1 Abrams tanks to get the Germans to move off the dime, which in turn frees up Leopards from various European countries. That from Mike. Russ writes, so long as the Russian people support Putin's war, and given that more than half of the world's nations continue to politely ignore the Russian assault on Ukraine, and given that more than half of the world's resources continue to be available to Russia, it is unlikely that Russia will suffer much economic damage over the war. Putin will continue to shuttle tens of thousands of conscripts to the front. The tanks will make little difference. That from Russ. We then go to Brian, who writes about Biden's reluctance. Could it be due to the difference between defensive and offensive weapons? And, of course, panel, feel free to jump in whenever you would like.
Well, Biden tried to make it clear that this is a defensive issue for the NATO alliance, and that they would not go on the offense against Russia. So that calculation, at least publicly, has been made.
Well, right, Ira, but there's one more thing to remember, and that is that the United States is the place where they make the weapons. And when you factor in that very fact that, you know, this is our economy that we're talking about here, it's something you got to remember at every moment.
Mark and Jill, let's see, did they both write this letter? No, Mark wrote this letter. Biden's decision to send Abram tanks to Ukraine demonstrates his sound and deliberate decision-making process. His so-called reluctance is a consequence of the advice of the military telling him that the Abrams tanks are hard to maintain, expensive to operate, and not conducive to the battlefield in Ukraine. The German Leopard tanks, perfectly suited for the task at hand, but German Chancellor Scholz refused to act without the U.S. also sending tanks. Consequently, we needed to put skin in the game, which would allow other European countries to send their Leopard tanks. That from Mark.
You know, I want to go back to that moment when the reluctant word was used. Of course we're reluctant. What sane nation in the world doesn't say, as they are committing forces or committing weapons, that they're reluctant to do it? They say it, but whether or not it means anything is another whole story.
Richard writes, could the panel address the less than thinly veiled nuclear threats from Russia now that Ukraine is poised to receive the Leopard, Challenger, and Abrams tanks and longer-range missiles? It is increasingly likely that they will be able to cut off the land bridge to and from Crimea. What is the end game in the event of an increasingly likely Ukrainian victory? Surely Putin cannot afford to capitulate. That from Richard.
So following up on that, if he can't afford to capitulate, what can he afford to do? I asked the panel.
Does anyone on the panel wish to answer the gentleman from Massachusetts?
Darn.
Question?
Well,
I think there has to be some definition of what success looks like. You know, there seems to be a changing the definition keeps changing. So what is it? Is it now there's talk of there being a desire to recapture some of the places that that Russia has overrun? Is that, you know, is taking that back the definition of success here? Beating back the Russian army till it goes back to its quarters in Russia, allowing for some kind of middle ground here, some type of agreement where part of the land that has been overrun is ceded to the Russians. It just keeps changing all the time, and that's what's so worrisome. What is the definition of success?
We go to Harleen, who said, are we slowly escalating the war with Russia? Did Trump give secrets on nuclear weapons and missing documents to Putin? Is Putin willing to wait for the MAGA Republicans who support him to continue gaining power for Trump to gain the presidency again? Well, there's a lot there, isn't there?
There is. It's a good letter. And it raises a lot of very dangerous issues.
Let's see. Heather says, from what I understand, the hesitancy with the U.S. sending tanks to Ukraine was more about logistics than support. U.S. tanks take a lot more fuel or are very expensive to maintain and are difficult to train for. The White House also argued that the tanks used by Germany and other European countries are more readily available. I just wanted to point that out because I don't think support is an issue. That's from Heather, who says she enjoys living, listening, or living too, probably, but listening every day.
Joe, if I could just respond to that.
Of course.
You know, I think that is an issue, but it's not the issue.
And it also depends on who you ask. As mentioned, there is this, I think from the president's standpoint and others, even members of the cabinet, this concern about sending the message that we're trying to advance or actually go to war with Russia. We're provoking. And so, again, it goes back to this very fine line that the United States and the president is walking. So while that statement was made, I think it was at surface level, a reason to say, to justify why we should not. But I think that there's some other underlying issues that we also have to be conscious of.
So what do you think? Do you think we are on some level, somewhere out there, trying to engage Russia, the old Soviets, into some kind of war? Dead air.
I missed the first
Do you think
part
we are
trying
to push
question.
Them into some kind? Do you think we are trying to push the Russians into some? We, the United States, are trying to push the Russians into some kind of a confrontation with us?
No, I do not personally.
Me too.
No.
I agree.
Ellen writes, I also think. Go ahead, Dan.
I'm sorry, Joe. No, I was going to say this is part of the discussion, I think, that really hasn't been focused on, but it should be. I mean, by virtue of the fact that we're learning so much about Russia's ability to wage war and how this works on the battlefield, you know, there's an advantage to that. I mean, yes, it's costing us a lot of money, but you can bet your bottom dollar that there's a lot of newly acquired information and intel from the battlefield that we're benefiting from should, you know, there be another conflict somewhere else involving Russia, or in case this does go to the next level. And also, you know, I'm concerned, too, that war really benefits the military-industrial complex more than anyone else. So, you know, there is a way here that I see that, you know, any war is not good for the world. I mean, there's some serious risks involved here, including the whole nuclear disaster aspect of it, not just in terms of a nuclear bomb, but nuclear power plants. And so, you know, I do think that there needs to be some level of caution here, that we need to consider some of the other ramifications involved here. But I just think that, you know, no one on this panel, I believe, thinks that war is a good idea. But understanding the geopolitical things that are at risk here, I think we're locked in this battle, and it's not going to be any sign of relief anytime soon.
One more letter before we go to a break. This from Ellen. I especially appreciate hearing Linda Ellerbee's brilliant and compassionate voice this morning. Now a grandmother, I'm so terrified as to the state of the world today. She forever offers a most enlightening point of view. In fact, your panel today is right on and so amazing in their say on the issues surrounding NATO and the actions regarding the tanks. And yes, the doomsday clock is beyond terrifying, for all the more than reasonable reasons offered as to why they have increased the risk of the end of the world. I want to cry looking into the eyes of all our beautiful children. We'll pause there. We'll take a break. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel for this Thursday morning. It's the 26th of January, 48 minutes past 9 o'clock. Alan Chartok, Dorcia Pleers, Linda Ellerbee, Ira Fussfeld, and Dan Arizari on our program this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We have several, so I'd like to go through them again. Panel, if you hear anything that catches your ear, please speak up. We'd love to hear from you. Lynn says, dear panel, what does it say that there are so many logistical issues that impair use of the Abrams? Why doesn't the U.S. have a more versatile and nimble vehicle? Unless we're fighting a ground war on this continent, it seems to have limited value, since any future conflict is more likely to be overseas. That from Linda. We move on to Ralph, who says, war with Russia? We don't stand a chance. We need leaders that have a backbone, and we don't have any. Then we go to Gregory, who writes, keep the big picture in focus. Russia invaded a free democracy, for God's sakes. Putin caused this. If the free world abandons Ukraine, who is next in Putin's crosshairs? Not to mention what China would see if the West got out. Get real, says Greg. Then we go to Spencer as we approach. I'm sorry, it's to Ed. It's Ed Spencer, but he goes by Ed. As we approach the one-year mark on the abject horror with no end in sight, that is the war in Ukraine, does anyone on the panel regret now that we didn't attempt to avert the war by assuring Putin at the end of last year that Ukraine would never be allowed to join NATO? And please keep in mind that some roundtable panelists have rightly, in my opinion, suggested that Ukraine will never, even now, be allowed to join NATO because it is simply too corrupt. Anyone have an answer for Ed?
Not me.
I don't, but I have to tell you, and my friends from the late 60s probably wouldn't recognize what I'm about to say, but I just think that the U.S. and the NATO allies have made a statement here to Russia, and that Putin has entirely underestimated that threat. He thought he was going to blow through Ukraine, and this would end in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And I believe that he is desperately trying to figure out a way out of this, and that importantly, I'm not convinced that he has the support of the Russian people. I think a lot of Russian people have been receiving untrue information from their government, and the more of the sons and daughters of Russians who come home in body bags, as that continues to grow, the illies in Russia is going to continue to grow. So I just think the ball is in Putin's court, and he's going to try to figure out a way to somehow get out of this. And the other thing, and it's not been verified by the West as far as I know, is that Putin allegedly has health issues, and so who knows how long he'll be in charge there if in fact health issues or the Politburo or whatever it is that it's called now steps in and orders a change. But I'm a little bit less pessimistic than the others are, I believe.
I they'll get somebody else if Putin goes, right? I mean,
yeah, but it,
we don't
but
assume that that's the end.
Putin.
What'd you say? Right.
It might be more of a Gorbachev, you know, somebody who is not an old line ex-KGB agent.
Mm-hmm. Linda?
I agree with Ira, and I also see this as a moment where NATO has stood up and said, yes, we are NATO, and we're going to behave like it. We are the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and this is who we are. We're the big boys, Jack. Come on, bring it on.
But doesn't have risk,
you got
does
it.
Doesn't Linda have an awful lot of risk?
I support this move. I know that probably my friends from the 60s would find that odd, too.
Now, we must have been in the same nightclubs.
Exactly. And I think that Biden is behaving and doing the right thing here. I truly do. And NATO is. It never pays to ignore a madman. We learned that first with Hitler. We've really learned it before that. We had that reinforced with Donald Trump, and we're having it reinforced with Putin. You can't ignore a madman. You have to take care of it.
Your technique for taking care of it, I'm fascinated, in this case, would be?
I'm sorry, Alan. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing.
Yeah, no, you said you have to take care of it. And I said,
you have to address it. You just can't ignore it. You can't say, okay, fine, let's just ignore Putin and he'll go away. He's not going away. We know that now. What is being done, I believe, is what has to be done.
But you know
what? You have to stand up to this bully.
You know,
say
so
no.
Please.
I would agree with that sentiment. And while we, you know, I've heard several letters, even some of the comments that we've made in terms of, you know, this fine line of not wanting to go to war, we are in a privileged position. Whereas if you think about the people of Ukraine who are currently in the midst of war, everything that they know has been completely changed, life disrupted, children, families traumatized. And so the reality is Russia has initiated this war, and America and other global partners have stepped up to say we stand with Ukraine. And so with that comes responsibility. You can't just in word say I'm with you and then not show action and put some political and muscle and resources behind that. So this, the actions that we're seeing here is backing up the words that have been echoed across the globe for those standing with Ukraine. And again, for the people of Ukraine who are in the midst of this trauma and horror, we have a responsibility, I feel, to do something about it.
So what muscle would you like to see us put into this?
Well, I think the decision to send the tanks is one example, and also some of the other resources. This is not just one action that has been displayed. Financial resources have been sent. Other war equipment and technology has been sent. So that's the muscle that I'm talking about.
And, you know, China has been referenced a couple of times this morning. I think it would be foolish for us not to acknowledge that whatever we are doing currently in Ukraine is supposed to send a message to China vis-a-vis Taiwan. I mean, Taiwan, if China makes a move on Taiwan, U.S. has already pledged to defend it, and I suspect that unlike in Ukraine, it would not rule out sending troops to help. And there is where a real shooting war could emerge. But that's why I believe a lot of this current strategy is aimed at sending China a message as well.
Dan Irizarry.
I'm just speculating. I wonder what this conversation will look like in the second year of this conflict. At this time next year, if things are deadlocked still, no one has gotten the upper hand, what is Europe going to be thinking? What is, you know, the Republican, the crazies in the House, what are they going to be saying about this conflict? And don't forget, we have a looming budget battle, the debt ceiling battle. Are the Republicans going to try to exact some kind of reduction in expenditures for this war as part of not breaking the debt ceiling?
Good question.
Just food for thought.
Well, right now there is bipartisan support for this tanks move. I know the only group that is apparently opposed to this and any other spending in Ukraine is the very small Marjorie Taylor Group, Green Group. When she asked the other day, "What is Ukraine the 51st state?" Meaning, why are we putting all this money in there? But that's a very small number of people politically. So, what would change the Republicans' mind? The broader, more moderate. Dare I say the word moderate, would be if the constituents rose up. But I don't think that's going to happen as long as there are no soldiers of ours in that region.
Anybody else on that? All right, let me go to...
I don't think it's ever safe to ignore the Marjorie Taylor Greens of this world. My God, she's got the ineffective Kevin McCarthy in her corner now and giving her prime assignments. I don't know where the crazies will be next year, but I know this, they're not going to turn sane.
Yeah, they won't suddenly like wake up and be cured.
It was all a bad dream, and right. We didn't mean any of it. Yeah.
Oh wow, I'm sane again.
And we're really sorry about January 6th.
We blew our chance.
That was the...
Go ahead.
No, that's okay. I'm just ranting.
Good rants. We blew our chance in 2014 when Russia stole Crimea. That was like Czechoslovakia in the 30s, writes Suzanne. Kasten says, just wondering what the panel thinks. Is the invasion of Ukraine a Russian invasion or a Putin invasion? Thanks for the great work.
Well, that's a tough one because, you know, the stuff that I've been reading in the papers about the polling in Russia has been saying that the folks there are in favor of what Putin is doing. Have I read that wrong?
Yeah, well, what kind of information are they getting?
I don't know. I only
I'm
know
not
what
sure
I mean.
That they're getting this, the same news that we're getting.
Well, let's see. We have one more letter, and then we'll take a break. This from Stephen, who says, the Washington Post had a good piece on the head of the Wagner Group as possible Putin's successor. If so, he could be even worse. That from Steve. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll move on to other topics. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Dorsey Appliers, Ira Fussfeld, Dan Arizari, and Linda Ellerby on the panel this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's great to have you with us this morning. We welcome your thoughts, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to change subjects now and go to the state of Florida. The governor there, Ron DeSantis, is facing mounting backlash regarding his administration's decision to prohibit an advanced placement high school course on African American studies, with black leaders rallying in the Capitol, a prominent civil rights lawyer threatening to sue, and state lawmakers urging him to reverse the decision. Attorney Ben Crump accused DeSantis of violating the federal and state constitutions Wednesday by refusing to permit the course. His legal team noted that a federal judge found a 2010 law in Arizona that banned a Mexican-American studies program from Tucson schools unconstitutional and officials motivated by racial animus. The State Department of Education contends that the class is inexplicably contrary to Florida law. A new education law championed by DeSantis requires lessons on race be taught in a, quote, an objective manner, and, quote, not used to indoctrinate or persuade students to a particular point of view. Some education advocates and teachers say the law is so broadly framed that it is having a chilling effect on the teaching of black history. Dorsey, I'll go to you first, and interested to hear your thoughts on this.
Yes. So this is, I really feel that this is an overreach and abuse of government and political power. It's an attempt to whitewash black history, which is America history. And we've seen the danger of that historically, as well as present day, even with the insurrection and the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd. The danger when you attempt to only tell one side of America's history with a slant on European history. And what that does is paints this picture that of who matters and who doesn't matter in this country. And then it also prevents us from getting to learn and understand about different culture. And some of the differences that we have as American citizens. And so this government historically and school systems historically have not taught Black history, Indigenous people history, or any other history except European history. That's been the tone and tenor, and hence why we have so many problems today in this country as it relates to race relations. And it also really illuminates this double standard that we're seeing from this administration in Florida, where there is this attempt to prevent this particular course and other courses like it and its advanced placement status. However, when you look at the European history course, it has already been permitted and its advanced placement status. So, again, the message that you send when there is a double standard and you choose to censor history. And then lastly, and I of course I want others to be able to chime in here, this notion of teaching history, Black history, from an objective perspective. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, what does that mean? Yes.
Yeah, I have no idea what that means. So we're in definitely scary times here. Okay, I'm curious.
I know what it means.
Go, Linda.
It means to not teach the history of Black people, to not teach a non-European male-centric Christian history, is in fact to teach white supremacy. That is the point here. When you fail to teach everybody's history, what you're teaching is white supremacy. That is your message.
It
has not been useful to this country to do it this way. And to expand just a little bit on this, it's not just that we don't want to teach Black history, the history of people of color, the history of people we enslaved, or Native American history. It's this craziness that we as a nation, and not just some of our government, our politicians, we are not fond of learning any American history that makes America look bad. For example, for years I ran, my partner and I, Rolf Tessum and I, owned and ran a television production company. We sold documentaries and series, nonfiction stuff, to many networks. We wanted very hard to work with the History Channel, because I love history. And we proposed several things, but I recall very vividly what happened when we proposed a series on the underbelly of American history. Things that America had gotten very wrong. Now, enslaving a whole race of people, let's start with that one, okay? But that's not the only one. I mean, we wanted to do shows and do a series of shows not to bash America, but to say, we have not always been right, but we have learned and moved on. So, you know, we wanted to teach. Yes, My Lai happened. Yes, we burned the village in order to save it in Vietnam. Yes, the story of the St. Louis. I was never taught that growing up. The ship that Hitler sent, filled with close to 800 Jews, to prove that he was letting Jews out, and it came to America, and our government refused to let them in. And the ship went back to Europe, and more than 700 of those people died in the camps because the United States would not give them a home, a safe home. The Bells of Belenguiga, the United States massacred close to 50,000 Filipinos over ownership of some bells that now live in the United States. There are things that we have done in history that we need to acknowledge and say, yes, we did this. This was a very bad idea. Start with the fact that this country was already occupied when the Europeans came to it. And to grow is to acknowledge our mistakes and to move on and to not make them again and to not make them again. Yes, we have to know them. And to know them, we have to teach history. And to teach history, we have to know history. Where does this end?
What did the History Channel say to you?
They asked us if we had any really good stories about World War II because they sold really well.
Well,
they had, actually, they ran in the other direction. They were horrified that we wanted to tell American history where America had screwed up.
This is now the network of Pawn Stars, Swamp People, and Oak Island.
Yes, it was. That was the day we realized that the History Channel had no interest in history. So we moved on from there.
I would.
Well, let me ask you.
If I can go back,
sure.
I think that, you know, we've made the same points, but going back to this notion of the law. And this language, which is very ambiguous, I think for those of us who understand the history of racism in this country, it is clear what the end goal is of this this legislation. But for those who are having to implement it, interpret it at the ground level in the schools, this level of ambiguity creates confusion, and I think, and maybe that's the intention, and maybe that's the intention. So I just wanted to go back because this is actually law that people have to interpret and do something with and make decisions with. So, you know, again, very scary times, not just for Florida, but for the rest of us.
The State Education Department listed concerns, quote unquote, in the curriculum, including topics covering intersectionality and activism, Black feminist literary theory, and Black queer studies. Ira.
That's the Florida State Education Department.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Well, let's push DeSantis aside, literally and figuratively, and stop me if I'm wrong about this. But right now we have thousands of school boards, we have states, and everybody has their own education system. Is it fair to say that even without a Ron DeSantis, that the people who are learning in, Tupelo, Mississippi, are not seeing the same lesson plans as, say, somebody in Concord, you know, in New England? There is no universal curriculum that I'm aware of. So if I'm right, and we stop there when we consider what DeSantis is proposing, and he also, by the way, in addition to this African studies concern, has a another program that they may ban books from libraries. Does it require a national education curriculum, and what in hell are the chances of that ever happening? And could that, and if in fact it did happen, what is to say that it would not be the curriculum that I think this panel agrees it ought to be? Once again, I'm better at asking questions than answering.
No, it was a good question, and I think you asked the right question. And now, of course, education departments and chairs of education departments and professors, you know, have to put their heads together and make a decision as to what any of this might mean in the future. I don't have any great hopes that we're going to come out with any kind of coherent plan.
Dan Arizari.
So I'm really confused about, you know, this whole idea of free speech, right? And Ron DeSantis is a big promoter of free speech. I guess the right has, you know, rediscovered it somehow. And yet they're trying to quell the free speech in the classroom. That's one thing. The other thing is, aren't these electives? I mean, I remember long ago that going to an AP class was something you did if you desired to. It was not required of you, right? It's for bright kids who want to get college credits. So why are we fighting over this if you have a choice, ultimately, as a student, to pick one or the other? And then
because
the other kind of large...
you're in advanced placement. Kind of, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. The larger point that I was going to make is that, you know, a lot of this, and follow me, if you will, for a moment. I don't want to lose anybody. But part of this is still the lingering reaction to the fact that we had a black president. And in that, during his tenure, over 8 years, you could say that a lot of discussion was had about race. I'm not saying that the issue was resolved, but there was no shrinking back from these difficult discussions at that point. But then you had Donald Trump come in and convince a large swath of the population that all of this advancement about racial equity was in fact a robbing of white history. And, you know, it goes down to the removal of the statues and that whole fight. So I think it pays to think of this in larger historic terms. And this fight to erase the progress that was made, and you can discuss, you know, you can have your own opinion about how much advancement was made. But Obama won twice. He won the vote, the national vote, twice. And then Trump came in and said, you know what, I'm going to try to destroy his legacy. And DeSantis is, you know, obviously an acolyte of Trump, and he's just continuing to further that agenda.
Okay, I'll bite. Why did Obama win twice?
Because white folks, not just black folks and brown folks, voted for him.
And they voted for him because on some level they were what?
They believed that this was a moment where I think we could make progress on that issue. That he was a leader that deserved two terms, regardless of the color of his skin. I don't know. That might be a very, you know,
Pollyannish,
rose-colored look at it. But I think that there was a moment in history when people wanted to give the country an opportunity to move beyond this horrible tension that has existed since the original sin of slavery.
Let's go to a couple of the letters on this latest foolishness with DeSantis and Florida education law. Just another example of him picking a culture fight that he knows others will oppose so he can get Fox News snippets. Don't fall for the bait. Remember, Fox is bull, Trump is treason, DeSantis is worse. That from Greg. The let's see, we have a young friend that teaches middle school English in Florida. This from Peter. She's not allowed to have her students read a complete book. Excerpts, yes. Articles, yes. Parts of plays, yes. But not a complete book. With that already in place, what should we expect from the Florida, quote, education system? My guess would be not much. That from Eric. We then go to... Florida is anti-intellectualism and racism are the policies. They should be at least be requiring advanced swimming courses in all Florida schools. 80% of Florida will be underwater in the next 50 years due to climate change. These morons in the Florida government are banning gas bans. What could possibly go wrong? Why would anyone live in that cesspool of a state? I understand. All right, this goes on. We don't need to go much further into that rant. Anyone in politics who well, that's a good letter, but it doesn't make sense, so I'll move on from it. The whole situation with banning books and black history reminds me so much of the Scopes monkey trial. Where is the teacher with the same courage as Mr. Scopes? And that is from Fred of Averill Park. Okay, you changed topics on me. To go to the root of the Florida debate, look no further than Columbus Day. Will the truth regarding those events become ubiquitous in our schools and the real Columbus be exposed and not celebrated? That from Bob. We go to, as far as I know, says Earl, the AP history courses are not mandatory, but are elective courses. And then, let's see, I think that is it for the subject on Florida. Let's move on to other subjects while we, go ahead.
I just want to point out that this is not limited to Florida, and this is not new, and this is part of what we've been fighting for years. I was raised in Texas, and back in high school, let me just put it this way: a few years ago, I got a lot of calls from Houston. From friends who said, oh, you're going to be so happy because Robert E. Lee High School, which was a new high school when I was in school, has changed its name, and you will be so happy that, you know, I'm the pointy-head liberal in my group. You'll be so happy they have renamed it after our history teacher, who was a woman who taught us in junior high and in high school, taught us American history. And we wanted to call you because we know you'll be thrilled. And I thought, well, I know I'm supposed to be thrilled, and I am glad you've changed the name from Robert E. Lee. And I'm glad you've named it after a woman. But you named it after the woman who taught all of us for 6 years that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery, that slavery was nowhere in any part a cause of the Civil War. And we were taught that nonsense as fact. And yes, it wasn't until I got to college that someone pointed out that, you know, slavery might actually have had something to do with the Civil War. Now, I don't think this is any different from what I was telling you. What's different is that it's all these years later and the same old crap.
Right.
Forgive me, my vulgarity.
No, that
that wasn't vulgar.
Yeah, we could. My question, and obviously that's what others in your grade who did not have your teacher were being taught as well, right? I mean, that wasn't her personal philosophy.
Yes.
This was the curriculum of the time.
Throughout the 50s, yes. All over America, kids were taught this.
Let's see. We have a few moments. Yeah, go ahead.
Joe.
Yeah, Dorsey.
Can I make a few final points on the topic
sure
before
can.
We transition?
Yep, we have 3 minutes before a break. Go ahead.
I think one is that this is so ridiculous, this notion of trying to censor education in history. And it only takes into account books where, if you think about it, our youth have access to social media. They have access to TV. And so, again, it just begs the question, I can't even fathom what's on the mind of this person, because you cannot censor, and it's not the government's role to censor. I think the other point that I wanted to make is
who let the dogs out?
Hold on, we're with you, Dorsey. I think Luna has a couple things to say, but that's all right. Well, okay, go ahead.
There was also trending in the news was this notion that in Florida, also there are school libraries that have shut down because of the new laws. Books have to be vetted before they can be made available to students. And so there have been a series of steps that our librarians and schools have taken, such as putting paper up over books until the books can be vetted, closing the libraries. And it just sends such a dangerous message to the children, to the parents. And it has parents really conflicted
with their educational system and government in Florida. The other thing is the importance, why this underscores the importance of parents and other members of a child's community teaching them the truth about our history and where they fit in all of this. And so you can't, this is a great example of why you can't rely on the school system, you can't rely on government to do proactively do that. And it's up to us as members of a child's community to do that.
Dorsey, great points. Thank you very much. We will, we're going to take a break. Dan in Missouri has to leave us, but Dan, thank you very much for being a part of the program. And I appreciate your input, as always, and we look forward to you coming back. In the meantime, we will take a break. When we come back, the rest of the group will be with us, and we'll continue. We have some other great stories to talk about. We will do that and welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Last few moments with our group this morning, Alan Chartok, Ira Fussfeld, Dorsey Appleers, and Linda Ellerby. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I do want to go to this story. We've mentioned this several times this week, and I'd like to just talk a little bit more about it. Of course, there were two mass shootings earlier this week in the state of California, and we have been talking about those. And yet more information is coming out of about the shooting that took place in the Newport News, Virginia school district of Richneck Elementary School, where a shooting by a student, a six-year-old boy, shot his first-grade teacher in Virginia earlier this month. In the hours before, school leaders were warned three times that the boy might have a gun. That is according to a lawyer for the teacher. He said that yesterday, including requests from employees to search the boy's pockets, and a report from another child who said that the boy had shown him the gun at recess. In the fallout of the revelations and already facing mounting pressure from parents and educators, the school board in Newport News, Virginia, voted on Wednesday night to terminate the contract of the superintendent, George Parker. "We're going to have to become a much more student-disciplined and safety-oriented board and division, and that is potentially going to require a lot of new direction," said Douglas Brown, a board member who had been a supporter of Dr. Parker. The teacher's lawyer, Diane Toscano, had later had announced earlier on Wednesday plans to file a lawsuit against the school district, laying out a series of escalating warnings on the day of the shooting when a six-year-old boy took his mother's gun from home, brought it to Richneck Elementary School, and fired at the teacher, Abigail Zwerner. The shooting has raised alarms about the rising risk of gun violence in schools in the United States of America, now possible even at the hands of six-year-olds. It led to visceral demands for accountability from parents and educators in Newport News, where administrators at the elementary school have also left. Earlier in the day, Ms. Toscano, the lawyer, laid out a timeline of events that raised new and troubling questions about the school's response on the day of the shooting. I realize, of course, that whenever you get into one of these stories, it becomes that hindsight is 20/20. But seriously, Ira, what the hell?
Well, what the hell is it that the six-year-old had access to that gun?
Right.
The parents, who knows what the circumstances are, but and I'm not always the first one to say when there's a shooting, say, by a teenager or a young adult, that the parents should be charged with it. But I need to really be convinced hard that the parents are not responsible for this by enabling this child to get access to this gun. I mean, it just stuns me that that could happen. All of the rest of the stuff that they have to, in terms of ignoring warnings and the like, the school district will have to work that out. But the fact that this kid had a gun just startles me.
And the fact that they knew it, the fact that they were told about it, and the fact that nothing was done to remove the gun or the student from the classroom, not to mention the safety of the teacher who was shot, but also for the other students who were in the classroom that day. Linda.
Well, I agree with Ira. I mean, you get back to the gun is there. The gun is the elephant in the room, so to speak. However, I am not as kind as Ira. I also believe right now that they need to fire everyone in that administration that was told anything that day and didn't operate it on it. Not suspend them while an investigation, not hide them from the public, not let them unions hide them, not do anything. Fire them. Period. They were told they did nothing. It was cowardice. I am so tired of the cowardice around the gun issue. We are all to blame. We have let this happen. Politicians, many.
Yeah. The connection from Mexico must be spotty.
Somebody up there in Mexico must be censoring this.
All right, well, we'll check on that. Dorsey.
I will continue on that vein in terms of this speaking to the larger issue of not having effective gun laws in this country. Yes, we can get into the fact that this child, the parents' responsibility. I know that they mentioned that there was the gun was legally purchased, that there was a safety lock on the gun. But the reality is the child still had access to this gun, which is a problem. The other thing that this points to are failed systems when it comes to communication and policies within the schools. And I know that schools are already overburdened with so many demands and responsibilities, but this was a missed opportunity to save a life. There were several clarion calls for administration to step in, and the buck kept getting passed. And now we have a teacher who has been shot, and children who are traumatized, who witnessed a six-year-old child shoot the teacher in the classroom. And then the casualties of war. One, this child who is a baby. And now we'll have to live with the choices that they made on this particular day. And we can't even, you know, we talk about brain development. You know, we can't even get into the decision making for this child because it's a child.
Right.
The failed. My last point that I'll make because I just really didn't understand. Letting go of the teachers who were warned, the administration at the school who were warned, but the superintendent. I feel that we have created this knee-jerk reaction when something happens, the person at the top has to get let go as a way to say we did something about it. Firing the superintendent, I still am not clear as to what was the rationale for that decision. I understand that those who voted to let the superintendent go said that they were looking to move in a different direction when it came to things, for example, safety. But is the superintendent really to blame for this situation?
Well, if the superintendent knew about it and the superintendent was told three times and nothing was done, the superintendent is the person at the top. That would follow through, wouldn't it?
But was the superintendent the one informed?
Well,
or was it the school leadership?
My understanding is that the superintendent did know prior, but I do not know that for sure. And I don't know how much of this we really know for sure. These are a lot of what I read was coming, you know, in the article is coming from the lawyers of the teacher. So yes, I think there's a lot more, as Ira said, a lot more investigation that'll have to be.
And Joe, when it happens on your watch, and you are being supervised by somebody else, both you and the supervisor have something.
Well, right, and you know, also this, we saw this in Uvalde. Well, we didn't see it in Uvalde. We saw in Uvalde a situation where wheels were spinning for a really, 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 really long time, and people who were directly responsible were not taken out of the equation for months in some cases, and in fact, some still exist. Linda, we lost some of what you said. You were getting up into full rant mode, and I'm just sorry that we lost you at that point.
It probably wasn't important. I lost you all, too. I don't know what happened.
But we were talking about, you were, to Dorsey's point, about making...
I was just saying, it's time to hold them accountable. It's as in Uvalde, where the grown-ups, quote, grown-ups, didn't have the spine to go in because apparently some of them were afraid for their own lives. Or in this case, where the grown-ups didn't have the spine to act on being warned that a child had a gun. I'm just tired of the, oh, we can't talk about it, it's an ongoing investigation. When people are killed as a result of the caretaker's inaction, hold them accountable. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah. You know, the one thing, I'd like to just go back to what Dorsey was saying, because I take your point, Dorsey. You know, this young person, as you rightfully call a baby, 6 years old, and this was a student that not only had access to a firearm, and we have to figure that out, but also was a student who had severe behavioral problems. The student had mental health challenges. And we have seen an uptick in this across the country as a result of the pandemic. And schools all around the country are dealing with ramifications from that and trying to figure out what the right thing is. I mean, I think what makes this case so severe is the fact that they knew he had a gun. And so often you don't know what is going on with the student. And that idea that on top of everything else, we also have to worry about this child who has severe behavioral problems and should be taken care of before they're allowed to do something that will change the trajectory of their life.
I agree, Joe. And I think what was unfortunate in this instance is that this child's behavior, he was crying out for help. He threatened to set a teacher on fire.
Right.
Before the gun was brought to school. And so it was clear, and his parents were actually, according to what was reported, his parents had just been at the school because they had to come with him because of his behavior. So this child was crying out for help and unfortunately did not get the help that he needed.
Prior
and hence we
this,
have this situation on this our hands.
Tragic incident. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody who was with us this morning, all the folks who wrote in. Alan, thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for your leadership, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you also to Dan Irizarry. He had to leave at 10:30, but we thank him very much for being with us. Linda Ellerby, enjoy Mexico, and we'll talk to you very soon. I know you're on the schedule in a few weeks.
I'll be on the show next week.
I look forward to it. Always wonderful to have you here. Ira, thank you. We miss you, but I assume you'll be back in 2 weeks. Maybe not. And Dorsey and Players, thank you very much. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have the Congressional Corner right after this.